Hey, welcome, welcome,
welcome,
welcome to the Marshaverse. This is a place in the rest of the universe where I come to make shit make sense.
From the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, it's Midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Skills Hudson, as the problem child.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse. It's midnight, that, you know, magic time that marks the end of one day and the beginning of the next. Well, we're already in this one. It's yesterday, today, and tomorrow, all at once. And it has special significance to me and to my ancestors. Midnight is liberation time. It's also the time when the spirit world opens and allows us to worship in an ancestral kind of way. We'll get into all that at another time, but let's just say it's magic. And what makes magic special is that you're here with us. So we're going to have a wonderful time. My special guest this week is a young lady who makes her living pretending like she's old. Anyway, she's one of the funny women of a certain age, and we've worked together a couple of times, and she has a special place in my heart because she's the first woman, a comedian, who called me her comedy mom. I was so flattered, and I'm still flattered. I'm glad she's here, and we'll talk a little bit more when I bring out my sons and have a little conversation. But right now, we're going to do what we always do. We're going to start with a little libations, you know, a little refreshments. Once a week, we like to get together, have a little cannabis and cognac. That's what I like to relax with. And we don't overdo. We don't do this every day. We do this time of night. So once a week, we can chill. You know, our society is not set up for us to chill. And I think chill is probably the best revenge. So we're going to relax, have a drink. This week, I've been drinking, you know, out of glasses and cups that people give me because I like nice stuff and I'm cheap. I'm not really cheap, but it's always nice to use free stuff. And so I've been using cups and glasses from different places. And my wife made me some cups because I don't have a show that gives me stuff with my name on it. So she had these cups made. And this one says Marsha Warfield. She says Marshaverse and Goddess. And I like that. But I'm not going to drink the cognac out of this because last week I said I was feeling hoodish. And so I was going to drink my cognac out of one of my cups. And somebody sent me a comment that said, "You ain't no hood rat. Don't be drinking cognac out of no cups." And I understand that point, even though we can elaborate and get into how I feel about being hood and upper ghetto. We'll talk about that. But I refuse to let white supremacy determine what sort of glass I use for whatever I want to use it for. So I'm going to use a much more refined glass, but not a cognac snifter per se. I'm going to use this this wine glass, and it says strong black lead. I believe I got it from the Upshaws. And so it can serve the same function. It'll show us the cognac's legs, and it will allow us to heat the cognac to release its bouquet. There we go. And we'll swirl it around. See? You can see how it clings to the glass. And we can smell it like we know what the hell we're doing. And of course, I've had enough cognac. I pretty much do. But, oh, and what we're drinking is a cognac that fits the upper ghetto hood kind of mode. And that's Shannon Sharp. who's got his own problems, but decent cognac. So here's to you. And here's to us all. I'm going to have some water in my Marcia cup because it's something that's really reminiscent of my roots. I'll be drinking from a coffee cup. In addition, we're going to have a little cannabis. Again, we don't like just stay high and get high when we're too old for that. At least I am. You could do whatever you want. And I only encourage you to do this where it's legal and where it's permissible wherever you are. But the way I feel about it is if 6 o'clock is cocktail time, midnight can be cannabis time. So we have a church battery with a heavy hitters cartridge. And I think the strain this week is Blue Dream. I got to be careful with this because it's about 96% THC and I don't want to lose control. I think I might have lost control. Moving on, I was surfing the internet. I love social media, and so I spend a lot of time just seeing what people are talking about. I think it's a great way to keep your finger on the pulse of at least a portion of society. It's kind of like being able to look into a high rise and see in everybody's window. You know, you can see all kinds of things. And I saw somebody make a post, show a video talking about a movie. And it's not it didn't come out recently. It came out in 2020. And it's called Cracker. It's about a world where white people become black people's slaves. It's kind of like an updated White Man's Burden. Anyway, let me show you the video of what he was saying, and then we'll talk about it.
So everybody has been talking about this new series, Cracker. You can see the trailer on YouTube. Basically, the premise of the show, it's a modern day series where it's about where black people become slave owners and white people become the slaves. Like, and it's, you know, I've been seeing a lot of TikTok videos of conservative white people that are super scared by this premise coming up, right? They're like, oh my God, what if this actually happens? This is going to cause a divide. Like, let me tell you something, white people. If you're scared by this premise, it's because you've been shitty to black people over the years. Because me, I'm not worried about this premise of this TV show at all. Because even if this did happen in real life and white people became slaves to black people, I know that I would get to be a housecracker. Okay, big news about that housecracker thing. Y'all remember that video, right? Okay, so the short film Cracker aired today. Here's the links to where you can find them right here. Here are the links to find the show right there. And guess who told me that? The creator of the show, Dale Restigini. He literally called me yesterday. Yeah. Dale told me his vision for Cracker, his vision of like the project. And when they start filming it into a series next year, he told me that I have a role as the house cracker because of that video. Literally, because of that video, I get to literally be the house cracker officially. Like, how cool is that? So my content from here on out is going to be promoting Cracker, because guess what, y'all? Your boy is part of the show!
Okay, so it's a funny video, but his point that he would be able to hang because he would be a house cracker, it kind of conflates a lot of things that I think we get wrong. We talk about history as if it's written by everybody. American history is written by the people for whom it benefits. They say history is written by the winner, and that's not true. It's written by people who can write. It's edited by the winners. And so the story can be similar, but it can be told in a way that just totally distorts the truth. And one of those ways, in my opinion, is when you don't realize that everything you know is a lie, you kind of believe things And everything you know after that point is just wrong. One of the things we get wrong, in my opinion, is the whole colorism and house Negroes and field Negroes, and the assumption that Black people have always been as stupid as white people portray us to be. And that's never been true. Our history is not just a series of sporadic events when Black people showed some spine. Our history, the truth of it is, it's always been in rebellion. It's always been about liberation. It's always been about progressing to a more inclusive society that lives up to its creed. All men are created equal. That's not even good enough. All people are created equal. And Black people have always been pushing for that because of the situations we found ourselves in and because the larger society is set up, it's designed to protect its interests from our liberation. There's always been an imbalance and a day-night kind of situation where Black liberation happened at night, whereas white people committed all their crimes in the day. And it's why they want to restrict the history now. It's they want that society that the founders saw of the white men, by the white men, and for the white men. Black people, and it was evident in the nomination of Kamala Harris, are looking for an inclusive society where anybody and everybody shares in the bounty that is this country. And the magic of what we could be if we did commit to unity and humanity, but we don't. And so the history we get says that Black people bought the colorism standards hook, line, and sinker and didn't use those parameters to get around the system. In other words, we've never been as stupid as we've pretended to be to get where we wanted to be. And so this is evident in the Civil War, when Black maids and butlers and valets and cooks, they freely went about their business, and the soldiers freely talked about their plans and everything. And so those enslaved people took that information back to the Union and often thwarted military campaigns. This has been documented. I asked my chatbot, I said, were there any double agent throughout history where Black people pretended to be on the side of the white supremacists who like to use people and to use them to infiltrate and come back and give them information. I said, were there any successful double agents? And the chatbot said, we would know unless they were unsuccessful, but we have to assume that there were many. And so the history we get not only omits things, it flips our reality. So we believe that all of the light-skinned, biracial, whatever people aspired to be in the house because they just wanted to be close to the men that raped their mothers and sold them. It doesn't even make logical sense. But we've been taught this so often, this whole happy, darky, white supremacist mythology, that it's almost impossible not to believe it. But we have to put that all aside and understand that being a housecracker, Black people have never, ever, ever said that what we want to do is take over and put white people in bondage. I haven't seen that once. No, that's never been the goal. The goal is simply for you to stop obstructing inclusion. That's it. Nobody wants to subject white people to the inhumanity they've been subjected to. This is a fantasy in your mind. So we have to start really thinking about the past as if we might have been there. I've asked people, I say, Imagine you were born enslaved. They refuse. They refuse to imagine that. But until you do, you can't understand what might have truly been going on. You get these same sing-song, old massa, I just wish I could get at him. Man, wasn't nobody just singing and happy shit like that. That might have been the face they showed you, but that wasn't the face that they lived. And so I reject the notion that there were all of these Black people willing to sell out other Black people for a better position in slavery. What the hell is a better position in slavery? What is better? And how do you get it? What do you do? Take your resume to master the boss? I just think it's time that we re-examine my position. It's just ludicrous. But we believe this shit because it is constantly reinforced. And this is why this current administration wants to reteach this whole, whatever you call it, this whole notion that this is our truth. And in reality, Black people used those assumptions that we were not capable of cogent thought to our advantage. And we took this country from genocide and horrific abuse to 2024, when we could have formed a more perfect union, when we could have had a government representative of the people and not of the capitalist racist people. We rejected that on the basis of all of the false information we were getting that they bought in order to present this false information. And we missed a bet. So now we find ourselves in a position where people who thought they were going to be covered under the 2025 umbrella, who didn't understand that, no, it was never about you. You were never included. Your job was to oversee the rest of the people who were being oppressed too. You were not going to ascend to the upper levels of the pyramid, because there's only so much room up there anyway. And those are the people who want the total control. So we have to be more relaxed in our thinking. You know, if you're constantly being taught and stuff is being driven into your brain, you tend to, after a while, just accept it. It is true. You've heard it all your life. Whatever. Our society is not built for you to have time to relax and reflect and consider and contemplate. Because when you do, the truth becomes pretty obvious, especially if you don't limit yourself to any one segment of this society. If you allow yourself to explore as much as available to you, you soon find that none of the stuff we're taught is true and is worth thinking about and rejecting. And so that's my mission. That's why I invented the Marshaverse. That's why I the rules of the world, the mainstream that thinks that a God that looks like them gave them the right to own everybody else's shit. That's not the basis of this here, where I live. In this society, we just chill and we read and we learn and we think about things and we discuss things and we limit ourselves to things that not only make sense, but to celebrate the accomplishments that never get even mentioned to this point. You know, when I started thinking about the significance of midnight and looking it up and how Black people would find these hush harbors that they would go to at night to worship in their own way, to plan, to strategize, to dance, to socialize, and whole communities that were set up that built a parallel culture and infrastructure that allowed for us to travel and circumvent the dangers built into the larger society and to share information and all of those things. And I think about those things and want to talk about those things and share the joy of that and the recognition of that accomplishment. It's an amazing story when you think about it from start to finish and how much was accomplished with nothing. It gives new meaning to way out of no way. And so I'm going to always talk about it. And I'm going to always try to point out that where it sounds progressive and all that kind of whatever, for this man to say, I'd have been cool if black people took over. I'd be a housecracker. It's just white supremacist bullshit disguised as some kind of allyship. It's not. It's kind of insulting. Anyway, that's enough of me ranting. I'm going to get back to drinking and talking and introducing somebody who's probably got a lot to say about these subjects. And I'm going to ask her about them, too. She's on social media when I would see her posts. This was a long time ago. I'd see her posts. I was always struck not only by her humor and humanity, but smart. She was smart comedy. It's impressive and not just funny, thoughtful, and ultimately kind. It can be vicious. She can be vicious in her assessment, but it's all designed to be kind, to lead to a better place. And so I want to introduce to you a young lady I enjoy very much, and I'm so happy she's here. Please say hello to Leanne Lord. Hi, honey.
Hey.
How are you this evening?
Well, I'm actually at this moment walking on air for those very, very kind words. My publicist is fired. You are it.
Oh, well, honey, it's easy to say, tell the truth. It's easy to tell the truth. I'm only reflecting what I see. So are you having refreshments with us?
A refreshment of sorts. It's just hot water and lemon for me, because we are at a little bit of a time difference.
Yes,
so
we
one
are.
One must calibrate for that. But this too is a mug that someone sent me. So very, very serendipitous that
and
we
fitting.
Would both.
It's very fitting.
Our majesty. Yes.
Now, you heard what I was saying about colorism and all this.
Oh, did I?
And now I'm going to be a little indelicate, because I know you have understanding of where I'm coming from.
Yes, ma'am.
You're very articulate. You're also, you can pass a paper bag test. You've had the light skin with funny eyes comment. Mm-hmm. You've heard that many times. And people making assumptions about you simply because of how you look. I talk about being up ghetto, because in the black community, we don't fit on the larger color scale. We are the bottom of the color scale. We are our own class. So we had to make our own class differentials. And we have ghetto and upper ghetto and middle ghetto and low ghetto and hood and country. So those are ours. How were you? I assume you were upper ghetto, because you're related to both of your parents and probably grew up in a house.
Okay, so by that barometer, yes, two parents, married before I got here, which is wild. Yeah, and they stuck around for the whole shot to raise me.
They're one and only?
The one and only that they loved. No, let me not say that. That's mean. You know what it is? I'm the youngest and the only girl. And so that was a little bit like being royalty. So I was, some people would say spoiled. My dad always would say well-loved, because I assumed that what I had, everybody had, until I got out in the world. It was somewhere around the age of 12 and 13. I'm like, oh, not everybody's got a mom and dad. Not everybody has their own room. Not everybody goes to Catholic school. And everybody shouldn't.
So how did that shape you? How were you? Did you have a rebellious phase?
To hear tell it, my teenage years, although comparatively, it was just, you know, not off the charts. But somewhere, I think between, I want to say like 16 to 19. My dad, who is like, my dad was like the dad. Like me and my dad were very, very close. But those years were a little rocky because he was raised Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. You know, he was not middle class. I was. So, and so there, I say that to mean I was sheltered. They kept me from a lot of things. So I thought they were holding me back from the world when they actually knew what was out there. I think this is a classic parent-kid struggle. I'm 19, like, you don't understand me. And they're like, oh, girl, we were you. Like, how do you not see that? Yeah. And so I think that was the main struggle that we had. And it wasn't that bad. It well, you know, they did get a little grayer.
Yeah, a little blackish kind of situation where the kids grow up better than you because you want them to grow up better than you, but then they turn out in ways you don't expect. You know, it's kind of growing pains. It's kind of, we've seen this movie.
I've heard my cousin and I talk about this all the time that our dads, similar backgrounds, you know, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, you know, immigrant parents, you know, I'm second generation, and the expectation was different and they worked really hard for us to have different lives. And then their concern became, well, did we make it too easy? Did we shield them from too much? Should we have told them more? And I'm not a parent, you know, I'm just raising a cat who's really raising me. You know, I would like to think people do the best they can. It's just sometimes that best is on a curve.
Well, everybody don't have a crystal ball like I do.
And well, so there you go.
They can't really see into the future. But do you have cousins who are like maybe from different socioeconomic?
Oh, you know I do. Come on. Okay. Now.
So now what was that like?
There's the I don't know, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air side, not that high at all. And then there's the Cosby Show side and the Good Time side. That's a little bit, a lot more accurate for Bobby.
So how was that when they called you bright skin and bougie?
Because you know they did.
Yeah, with your bougie ass.
I mean, well, here's the weird thing. The light skin in my family, it's not evenly distributed. Like some people got it, some people don't. I'm the only one in my generation that has these color eyes, and it skips a generation, apparently, because my parents don't have it. My two grandfathers on both sides had it. So that's like the test, like who babied this? But I feel, again, this is where the shielding and the protecting comes in. I was encouraged to read. I was encouraged to be smart. I was encouraged to be myself. The bougie didn't come till later, you know, buying into the nonsense materialism. But I like that you asked about it in a family, because family is, you have all of that in the community and one is not better than the other. The teamwork here has to be on point. That's how we get anywhere. It kind of, I feel, references back to how you opened the show when right. You were talking about house Negroes, field Negroes. No, everybody's slaving, y'all. Right. None of these situations is ideal. I know we have history books that not history books, but novels or whatever that have been written, but I think you really need to go back to the slave narratives and what people said or wrote about their actual experience, not something that was dramatized. And it is quite horrifying. And from that standpoint, you understand why they don't want to teach real history here.
No, there was a lot more collusion on our part than people want to get. And it's unfortunate because young people, having heard this narrative from minstrelsy on about their history, tend to internalize it and are ashamed of it, when the truth of it is so triumphant and so amazing, like a Mission Impossible for 300-400 years. I mean, that the shame of it is that we don't really teach it and show it that way. Like I said, it's always, Lord, massa gonna send us away. Man, wasn't nobody singing no shit about that. And
not at
we
all.
Have to also check that I'm talking a lot, but what I've found is these chatbots are regurgitating the history that it's been input.
Well,
so
yeah.
You get back these answers that you have to challenge. I cuss out my chatbot a lot. Like, no, that ain't right. You're basing this on a white supremacist protection bubble and make it come back with a different narrative.
I don't know why people are surprised at this. I mean, it's garbage in, garbage out. Who's programming these? You know, and while you have the foresight to go, well, that's not right, and you challenge it or you ask more questions, or you go, you know what, I'm just gonna get this book off my shelf. Younger generations, and I'm really talking about kids who are in school right now, maybe just slightly out, don't have that wherewithal. They don't have that capacity. They are now copying and pasting. They're not truly learning and becoming discerning, which is very, very troubling. From a historical perspective as well, I mean, they've never wanted us to know this. Never, ever. You know, they were rewriting on the fly. Like, no, we won that by a lot, not by little. So yeah. I thought I knew stuff, but then I went to visit the National Museum of African American History and Culture. I have now been 3 times.
Okay.
And have you been, Marcia?
Yeah.
Okay. I
love Black American History Museum.
Okay.
That's my thing. And yes, I've been twice and I can't wait to go again.
I can't wait to go again.
I just went bus tours of people, just all kind of people.
Yes. Yes. Did you start in the basement or did you start at culture? Okay.
The first
okay.
time I went with a what do you call them? Not a curator.
Like a docent.
Yes, we had a tour, and we started, and it was after hours, and we started in the basement, and we must have stayed in there way too long because you miss so much. You miss so much trying to just get through.
That's why you have to go multiple times.
As you go up, and then the Serenity Room.
What there should be my name should be carved in one of those seats. I had to sit down.
Okay, I went there after the Emmett Till exhibition, and by the time you get there, you're shell shocked, and you go in there, and all these other people, and usually what it is, it's like one person from a group just can't go anymore right at that point, and so that one person goes and sits down. And they're like gamblers in Vegas when they ain't got no more money and don't know how to go get home. And they sit there and they just sit there. And you finally have the courage to say, that was a lot, wasn't it? And the relief. And they reach out to you like for a lifeline. And then you have this deep emotional connection with somebody you've never seen before in your life because you've just shared probably one of the most harrowing adventures you've ever been on.
I have more than once sat in that room and handed somebody a tissue because it was a lot. Or I'm walking through the basement, the bottom floor, the one, and everybody, the lighting is different, how low the ceiling is, they set a mood.
Yeah.
And I have done this and had it done to me where somebody just gently put their hands on somebody's shoulder because like you get to the fact that they burn the world down with sugar.
Yeah.
For sugar and cotton.
Yeah.
They destroyed lives and knew they were doing it. It wasn't no like, oh, we don't know what. No, they knew exactly what they were doing. They pulled the church in to help rationalize what they are doing. And they have not changed.
No.
They've just repackaged it in different ways. And this is an ongoing criminal enterprise. Right.
And so it's a harrowing experience, but the listening stations, and where they ask you to share your stories in these different rooms, and people do. And they ask you for your Bibles, your family Bibles, or things you might want to loan to the museum so you can so they can get the history that's in there. But
I got a whole house of stuff. My parents live at, listen, y'all need some Iceberg Slim novels?
No, nobody needs Iceberg Slim novels. No, I remember it's 1969 when I read the first one. No, we don't need that. But once you come out of that Serenity Room and you finally, okay, you've been whooped and you come out and you go upstairs.
You go to culture.
There's this explosion of it's like running through the woods and finally seeing a clearing and going freedom. It's just soul lifting. The sixth and seventh floor.
It's the struggle mixed with creativity and joy, and you realize where you come from. It almost re-embeds that responsibility. Like, the beginning was horrific and things are still not great, but look what we're able to do even with the boot on our neck.
Yeah.
Like what? I don't know. I feel like a wallflower, but after seeing something like that and having it aggregated the way it was aggregated, like, okay, I do come from stronger stuff. I just didn't think I'd need to use it.
Okay. No. Well, you know, I am my ancestors.
Am my ancestors.
And I hope that I can live up to the standards they set. Now, here's another thing. We need what those young people need is not fussing. They need the guidance that is naturally given to us with age, the wisdom of age. We've been in a concentrated effort to demonize age and our old people, and so we've made them their value almost invisible for young people. Mm-hmm. You are involved in a project, Funny Women of a Certain Age. Now, this is not a Black project per se, but women have not had such a great ride in this country. You know, they never said all women were created equal. They said all men, period. And as a comedian, we've always been marginalized anyway. And as older comedians, you know, when I started, women ain't funny was doctrine. That was the truth. And so being involved with Funny Women of a Certain Age is as political as it is anything else. How'd you get involved?
Oh, goodness. The creator, Carol Montgomery, is a friend of mine. I've known Carol we met at the Boston Comedy Festival on the ladies show, because, you know, why would we be sprinkled throughout? But she was emceeing the ladies show, and she's still living in Vegas then. And we just hit it off. We became very, very good friends. We've done military tours together for Armed Forces Entertainment, and our relationship grew over the years, and she created this show. And we were doing residencies around the city because she kept saying, I have so many wonderful, funny friends who, I guess, made the mistake of acknowledging birthdays. You know, aging is a crime. And it's like, you don't get, if you've been doing this, if you've been in the trenches for a while, like anything else, you don't get worse. You get better at what you're doing. And she was seeing, or what she wasn't seeing, were her friends, you know, women just like her and I, who were not getting work, who were not being seen in the city. I'm sure men can cry a tale of woe, but we see more older men making money or being in higher positions or getting booked than women. And she wanted to change that. And she did. And I was lucky enough to come along for the ride.
Lie about your age now, right? No. You're not in that age bracket.
She was counting when she started. She was counting women over 40.
Okay.
Who had been doing comedy, you know, 20, 30 years. Because it's not just you're 90 and you decide to start doing stand-up. You know, at least for the specials, when she did the TV specials, these were all, you know, celebrity, well, not celebrity, but those are our hosts, but seasoned comics who, I mean, we do this, you know, this isn't, hey, I wonder what this open mic is about. But no, I am one of the youngest that's on the tour and in the group. And I gotta say, I love that, because just in comedy in general, I am not the youngest one in the room, and I'm like, what are these children talking about? They old, and they 25. It used to bother me, but I'm like, you know what? Everybody is having their experience. And if they are 25, that is the oldest they've ever been.
Correct.
And it's different. You know, the intergenerational squabbling is ridiculous on some level, and it's intentional.
Especially since that's a resource. It's not just, you know, absolutely, there's a reason why there are old people. Old people, And that could tell you what to do, just to kind of point things out along the way that you might not have understood or seen. And
absolutely. I'm sorry. I just want to say it's absolutely why I love the show, you know, because I'm the youngest on tour. It'll be me, somebody in their 60s, somebody in their 70s. And I get to sit down and be quiet. I get to ask a question for somebody that knows more or has been around more blocks than me. And I miss that. I miss that mentorship because people think you get older and you don't need it. And you absolutely do. I've never been this age. You know what I mean? Every level is a new level. And it's like, okay, what can y'all tell me? I need some help. I need some advice. I need some community. And to be in the company of my sisters, awesome.
You also, I have two books of yours?
Probably.
Yeah. How many books do you have?
Several, but the two that everybody knows are Real Women Do It Standing Up and Dick Jokes. Which I do have two volumes of that. One is you can actually get.
No, you have another one that about.
Not People with Parents. That wasn't widely released.
No, it's about.
About words?
Yeah.
Dick jokes.
Oh, okay.
I have it right here.
Oh, Dick.
You talking about this one?
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. Okay. Yes.
I'm a nerd. That. Yes.
I have that. And now, but People with Parents, that's kind of tangential. Whatever, you know what it is.
Tangential.
You care for your parents.
I did.
And you took us on that journey with you. And that was something I want you to tell us about. And not my impressions, but yours.
Well, I did a podcast. It's called People with Parents. And I actually, while I haven't done new episodes, I've left it up because people are always finding themselves in the situation of the role reversal of becoming the adult child of aging parents. And my parents hip, cool. They were retired. They were doing their thing. I know I'd go out on the road and in tour, I come back and they were fine, you know? And in my mind, they were always fine. But I started to see little things, you know, they were losing a step here and there. There were more medical appointments than I remembered. And I said, let me start paying attention. And it was eye-opening. And the more attention I paid, the more I start going to doctor's appointments, the more I start sort of assuming the reins of wrangling and managing and holy crap, and taking care of my parents. And it was, of course, I think this is only happening to me. I had no idea. I had no idea. I processed it as an artist. You know, I would talk about little stories on stage and I didn't think people would get it. I thought, oh, this is definitely going to alienate me. People aren't going to know what I'm talking about. I would have people come up to me, young and old, talking about, oh, my mom, my father-in-law, my this, my mom, my dad, my grandma, my grandpa, because I didn't realize how intergenerational caring responsibilities can be. Mm-hmm. You know, so that more people were in that situation, not just kids and their parents or adult children. And I processed it on stage. And I said, how do I talk to people? I really felt like I was just talking into the void when I started my podcast. Like, hey, if anybody's out there can tell me what this is, because I felt so alone. And then you do that. You stand at the top of the mountain, you shout out and people shout back. Like, it's not just you. Go get a lawyer. You're going to need some help.
Yeah. You know, it's okay. It's okay. I think that's one of the things that you miss when you don't have those elders, whether they're parents or not. There's somebody to say, it's okay, baby. I understand. You're going to go through this, but you'll be all right.
Yeah. And we don't talk about it. We don't talk about elder care and the lack of help that is really required for this sort of thing.
But it's more than that to me. It's our whole concept of family is designed for people to die alone. I mean, family to me is very expansive. It's communal. It's multi-generational. We don't rely on childcare outside the home because we have aunties, cousins, somebody who gonna be home all the time, whether it's a grandmother, grandfather, aunt, somebody, or somebody who works at night, or somebody. And if we're all, when I was coming up, the goal was for everybody to buy like a 6-flat and put 6 families in it that you know, so that there's always somebody there to take care of it. I didn't cook today. Well, I made spaghetti and whatever, so that you don't carry these family burdens from birth to death alone. But when we make it about one man, one woman, 2 children, and a station wagon, you've isolated people from their help.
How about that?
And from their base, their home. And yeah. It's, I think, a very dangerous model. And it's one that people have bought into to our detriment.
I was definitely raised in the soup of toxic individualism. So, and it's a bitch to get over. It's very tough.
But you make it funny, and you've been going on the road working with the women, funny women of a certain age, and you've also have a podcast.
Actually, not at the moment. Although I did, it was people with parents. It was my podcast. And while, again, I've not added additional episodes, I leave it up as a public service because people would find it and they would, someone would tell them to be this. She goes, I see it pop up my feed. And I go, oh, because she's like, because it was like, it's like, what's going to happen now? And I would just tell these little stories of struggling with my dad to get him to the doctor, or why is the house 90 degrees? You know, because he's messing with the thermostat.
Have you seen We Do Not Care women?
Yes, women I have.
We do not care.
And you know what? I'm loving that stage. I'm totally loving that stage. But I leave people with parents.
We have a podcast, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, we certainly do. That is run and helmed by Shelley Coleman, one of our resident funny women.
You were there when I did it.
I was so excited because I threatened everybody. I said, don't y'all dare have Marsha on and I not be there. I will burn this world down. Do you understand? Because you are foundational to me, ma'am. You are comedy mama number one.
Well, I just happened to be around when wasn't too many others of us, but.
You were there when I needed to see you, when I was falling in love with stand-up and I'm flipping channels, because you know we had to manually do that back then. And to see someone who looked like me, like it hadn't occurred to me. It hadn't occurred to me. That's why representation matters. Like, what? Because I was too young for Mom's Mabley. That I didn't see her, you know, real time. Right. I saw you and Bertice Berry, but I saw you first. And I'm like, we could do that? you were so effortless and funny and had I didn't give a damn attitude. And it was like, oh, I'm here for this. I'm here for this all day, every day. So yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And I have the game's in good hands.
I'm going back to bed now. I'm going. Good night. Thank you. That's it. The game is in good hands, y'all. That's it.
I was very flattered when you said, that's my comedy mama. I'm somebody's comedy mama. I was very, very flattered. Still flattered. I find it very exciting. But now I have my sons.
Yes.
Who, first of all, before we bring them out, I want to show you when they were a little younger. When they were a little younger and we were working together. Just take a look at these pictures. There's pictures of the three of us coming down the escalator from the Strat doing one of those kind of things. And then Stephen made a collage of us as the Brady Bunch. So we're going to, it's a story of a lovely lady. So we're going to show that.
Okay.
And right now, that you have some idea who they are, I want to introduce you to my youngest son, my adorable problem child. I love him so much. He has his own way of doing things. And we're going to see a little video before he comes out. Take a look at this.
Even though you were just hiding someone, nigga, I've been taking care of your bitch ass. world star. She like, fuck that.
I have no idea what his video is. It's Fairy Skills in the Streets, and we follow his adventures. Okay, Mr. Skills, I want you to come out and say hello to my friend, Leanne Lord. Leanne,
hi.
My friend Skills. That's
hello,
it.
Hello, Leanne. Hello,
hello, hello.
I'm gonna be totally honest with you. When she told me last week we was having somebody on that was calling her the comedy mom, I was like, yeah, okay. Somebody calling my mom comedy mom. Let me, because I really never, mom, I'm gonna tell the truth. I really never do the work of looking up the person that we interviewing, but I did this time. And that's why I was like, let me see who is this that's calling my come. And I knew of you, you know what I'm saying? But to get more info and like seven books, I was like, oh, okay. All right.
So now you're happy you have a sister, right?
Yes, I am. I start letting people know, you know, I got a sister. Like, oh, you got a copy sister? Yeah, I do. Goddamn.
All right, and you have a brother, and he is our producer here on this show. He made the video, the collage of us as the Brady Bunch, and he is going to come out. First, watch him gay mansplain everything.
Hello. Today on Gay Mansplaining, we're going to talk about washing the dishes. Sounds really easy, doesn't it? Well, it really is. And some people, maybe yourself, makes it really hard and bugs the shit out of everybody you live with. So we're going to go over it. There's a few things that people do that they need to know that they can stop doing it. One of those things is washing the dishes by hand when they have a dishwasher. There's a lot of people who do this, and many of us don't understand why they do this. If you have a dishwasher, why are you hand washing the dishes? Some people think that the dishes are gonna have to be rinsed and washed anyway, so before you put them in the dishwasher, so why not just wash them by hand anyhow? Other people believe that the dishwasher never really does the job in the first place, and it's not very clean when it's done, so they wash them by hand. This, actually, both of those thought patterns are absolutely ridiculous and from a different age. You must be from the 1900s, because this is 2025, and anybody who has any kind of schedule knows that it's a lot more convenient, and it's a lot better for the environment, and it's a lot more sanitary to use the dishwasher that you paid for. Yes. So, one of the things that you need to know is the dishwasher is actually able to get rid of debris, food debris, and food particles, and anything that's kind of easily broken down, and some things that are even difficult to break down. But most dishwashing detergents will tell you that all you have to do is scrape, load, and then you're done. That's it. Isn't that nice? They gave you a whole pictorial right here that said scrape, then load, and that's all you need to do. But some of you have decided that this is a better thing. I would like to tell you, you're wrong. See, what's going on is when you hand wash dishes, you leave the water running. And that's gallons and gallons and gallons of water. Whereas dishwashers, they run on a limited source of water, and they also use heating elements even when there's no water present to help sanitize the dishes.
Yay!
Isn't that interesting? So you're using less water on more dishes and they're cleaner. Isn't that amazing that technology has done that? After all, we can put a man on the moon, we must be able to clean a dish automatically. So, you know, give yourself a break and the rest of the people in the house who you forbid to use the dishwasher, let them use the dishwasher. If it's broken, get the damn thing fixed. So do this, not for yourself, but for the loved ones in your life. Don't you think that would be better? I do too. So use your dishwasher.
Well, I feel like we learned something here. Anyway,
no, we did.
I want you to say hello to my oldest son. He looks just like me, and I know you're going to hit it off. I mean, you've talked to him, but now you're going to meet him in person. Say hello to Stephen Roberts.
Hello.
Stephen.
Hey,
hello.
Hey,
I'm here.
Hey.
Hi, Leanne. How are you?
I'm great. And actually, hello to both of you. And Skills, listen, thank you for doing your due diligence and finding me worthy. I appreciate that. And
well, there's no other choice. Nobody's going to do their due diligence and say, who is this chick? It's impossible for them not to be impressed.
Then you are not familiar with Tinder, ma'am.
Okay. No, I'm
That's
not.
A good
I'm
point.
Luckily happily married, so
I only lasted 24 hours. It was rough.
Now, are you finding dating challenging nowadays?
That's a trick question because I messed around and did it right and got engaged recently.
Yay! Yeah, I mean, you're not pregnant enough, and this is really something you want to do.
Yeah, it's love. It's totally love. Yeah, you know, shotguns, none of that. Yeah.
I just thought I'd ask, you know, as a concerned parent, I just want to make sure.
No, I appreciate it. Like,
Worthy? Is he worthy? Who is this person?
His name is Michael.
I see it. I see it on your face. I'm happy for you.
Yeah, no, he's a very good human being. He is smart. He is funny. He is not in the business. Because that's what all my comic friends go. They go, girl, see a comic? No. Whew! So, yeah, no. Dodge that bullet this time around. But, no, he's just a wonderful human being. He makes me laugh. He's incredibly compassionate. And my cat likes him. So that was the best start ever.
All right. I won't ask which cat. Anyway.
I'm a sip my tea.
Okay. Do either of you have a question for our esteemed guests and your comedy sister?
Yeah, I would like to ask her about her parents again, because I have parents who are going through this right now.
Ooh.
And, you know, my dad has had dementia for some time. And I don't know if you went through that particular adventure. You did. Okay. So I don't know how much I have a question as like, what was that like for you? What was dementia like? And was there one parent who did not have dementia? And how was that for them too? And how difficult was it for the other parent?
Okay, so it was my mom. My mom was diagnosed with, they said dementia, most likely Alzheimer's. And that diagnosis in and of itself was a terrible thing. We didn't know what we were seeing.
Right.
You know, we didn't know what this was. And you know, you go to the neurologist, you do the test, and then what? And so it seemed worse when we got a name for it. And my dad was being my dad, and he's like, okay, I got this. He's going to take care of her. And I still, part of me needed them to be okay. And he took care of her. He's older than her. And it took a toll on him to the point where I then had to start taking care of both of them. I came home from a trip and he had had a heart attack, like just trying to manage all of this on his own.
Yeah.
And so I stepped in, but having a parent that has Alzheimer's, and my dad later presented, but it was very, very close to, you know, that last year of his life. But I feel like when a parent has dementia or Alzheimer's, you lose them twice.
Oh.
And that's what's hard, to watch somebody fade right in front of your eyes and you can't stop it. And you try to approach things. At first I did, this is totally me, logical. We're gonna do this, we're gonna fight this, you know, all the doctors in the world, yada, yada. And there are some things you cannot stop. And I had to come to the point where my job was to make them comfortable in the home that they built. You know, if I could just keep them home for as long as I could, and I did manage. People ask me how old my parents were when I lost them. And I will tell you honestly, I don't know, because we stopped doing birthdays when my mom didn't understand what birthdays were. She didn't, you know what I mean? It's Monday, it's October, it's summer, it's, you know, no whenever. So I stopped counting. It was just day by day.
Now, I'm going to get to skills to say, ask you a question or say something, but I wanted to take the moment to make this point. You both are very funny people. We're all funny people. And I wasn't my, well, I did go through it with my parents, but also with my sister, grieving her illness and then her passing, and trying to revive my career at the same time. How do you manage that when your heart is so heavy, not only heavy during the day, but the responsibility that you carry to the point that sometimes doing what you love feels like cheating the person you're supposed to be caring for? How do you manage that? And what's that like?
My favorite refrain in the house was, I am not retired, you know, so I had two jobs. I had looking after them and, you know, managing and care managing and all that, and still performing. And I found that being on stage is what saved me. It was that place that I could go and still be me and do what I do. And, you know, there were times I remember flying home, literally parking, you know, getting here, picking my dad up, taking him to a doctor's appointment, and feeling fortunate enough, I had to get to this, that I had a non-traditional job that I could plan around what they needed. So I had to find some sanity or some grace in that. But I will tell you, a lot of that time, that was like a 5-year period for me, is blurry. If there was something major to happen, some major news, or you talk to me about something and I don't remember, or I met you in that time and I don't remember who you were, I was going through it. I did not have a lot of bandwidth. I found out the hard way. I didn't have the room for a relationship, because it was just too demanding. I couldn't give anyone the time that they would have deserved, that we would have deserved. But being on stage and writing and going up there in front of an audience that may or may not have known, or sharing that experience and making new friends, was absolutely crucial to me surviving that experience.
Okay, but it's interesting that people never assume. And I guess we do. We talk about the sad clown and all that stuff, but the reality of what that is, to actually have the responsibility of living with all its life be life in, as you're trying to not just make people laugh. You know, what comes with that to me is a responsibility to make things better.
Yes.
For everybody you come in contact with, not just your parents, your sister, your family, but the audience. You want to leave them something better.
I would have folks come up to me and say, and again, they're telling me their stories about their mom or their person, and they're laughing, you know, because they're having a similar experience. Like, that's what we as comics do on stage. By talking about our experiences, we're talking about theirs. We're hitting somebody in the audience. We're making them feel seen, making them feel a little bit better about what they're going through. But I will tell you, I've had laughing post-show conversations with people. I have held hands with people and cried in the lobby of the theater, you know, because, oh, you get it. I feel seen. And that's both of us.
Right.
So there's power in what we do.
Yes, and they thought they just went to the show to escape for a little bit, and they actually got a cathartic experience. It's wonderful.
As did we. Now, skills, now that you know your new comedy sister, how would you welcome her into the fold?
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask her about the out of the 7 books that you have written, what was like the experience, the feeling you had after finishing each book? And did you have like, have you had a feeling like this book was had a stronger feeling than the previous book that you written before that?
Okay, so quiet as it's kept, I didn't think I was writing a book. I didn't sit down and say, I want to do a book. The one that Marsha was talking about, dick jokes, I used to, this is the early days of social media, I would post, I started posting a word of the day. And it was always an odd, you know, an odd word or whatever. Because I had the parents that said, oh, if you don't know what a word is, you look it up. And I still would do that. But when I was a kid, I didn't want to. And so I would say, well, what does this word sound like it means? And it was, I was almost always wrong. But in my but in my adulthood, I said, oh, that's fun. I should just try that again. And I was posting a word a day, every day, you know. And Joanna Brightley, the creator of the Black Women Laugh Fest, said, Leanne, you do this every day. You should put this together in a book. I was like, okay. And I was like, I had enough for a book. The same way I did Real Women Do It Standing Up. I was there, a collection of short humorous essays about being a woman. And I didn't start out writing a book. I started out doing a blog. And I just kept writing. And I just kept posting. And then I look up and I'm like, oh, I have enough to assemble and massage into a book. And it gave me something to do that wasn't dependent on the industry. Because if you're waiting on the entertainment industry to validate you or always have you working, or you really have to be sort of the your own catalyst, your own energizer. And that's what the books did for me. And it really was, when I finally put them together, a sense of accomplishment. I'm like, wow, look what I did. Now I know AI can do it faster, whatever. Yeah. But I continue to take pleasure in using and fine-tuning my brain.
It's so amazing that human beings can turn thoughts into things. You had a series of thoughts in your head that were relative to you, and now you have things with that will last, that will communicate with people generations from now.
That is the beauty of books.
It's so amazing that we can visit times and places gone by and imagine futures and all kinds of things because we have the capacity to think and communicate and share words. And if it was up to me, we would do this all night. But we have gone way beyond where we're supposed to go.
Oh my goodness, I'm sorry.
No, don't be. We don't really have limits. You know, some of these shows go, the Shannon Sharp shows, 9 hours of, you know, we ain't going that far. But we don't really have time limits here. But we've had a wonderful time talking to you, getting to know you. I feel, again, honored that you're here, that you have affection for me, and that affection is return 100-fold. I wish you all the best, and especially with your new love. I love the way your face and your whole body lit up. You know, somebody told me a long time ago, said when a woman likes you, you can always tell because they perch. Yeah. And you just went, you just started perching. And I think it's adorable. And I hope that if you take the next steps, that I can be there to share a glass of wine with you.
Oh, Marsha. What, no cognac for that one?
Well, you know, it's traditional. We have to do the tradition thing. Then we'll pull out the Hennessy, the official cognac of Black people, and and share a glass. Thank you, honey. And I don't know how to thank you anymore. I'm looking forward to the next time we work together.
I am too.
And I'm so happy, not just with the fact that we work together, that we found out that Terry Hatcher was funny.
Yes!
That's the thing that stands out the most from that episode to me. I had no idea. She did Night Court. She was funny as an actress. But she did stand up, and I'm like, Okay, go, girl.
She did a great job. Everybody's like, Terry Hatcher funny? Yeah, it's a relief to go, yes, Terry Hatcher's funny.
It's a great episode. It's a great series. I hope people tune in, and I hope you guys wish you all the best into the future.
Thank you. It has been re-released. It's on Apple TV, Google Play, and Amazon Prime Video. So there are many ways to access the Very Funny Women of a Certain Age experience.
Okay, well, my clip is circulating.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Comedy Dynamics put you up. Yes.
Yeah, it's circulated. So we're going to show it too. So
we out here.
Thank you so much, honey. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye, Leanne. Take care.
Bye, new family. Pleasure.
Wasn't that sweet?
Yeah, that was good. Good conversation.
What a lovely episode. She's a lovely lady. Yeah. It's a story of a lovely lady. I've been wanting to use that video, that clip of Brady Us that you did a long time ago.
Yeah.
I like
it. You should.
But now,
yes.
Now, I have a question. You know, once we get all of the official work done and it's just us, I have a question I'd like to ask you. I've been seeing online and social media comments a subject that concerns me. Is it true that there are men who won't wipe themselves because it's gay?
Where are you hearing this?
On social media. It's there. It's it happens a lot. That
I'm about to wipe my ass right now.
As much as you like being on the toilet, you're probably an expert at it.
I just wiped my ass right then.
And then smelled it. What the hell? But no, have you
never heard it's already wiped. Go ahead.
But have you not heard this? Have you ever heard this?
No, man. You be going on those deep dives on.
No, you don't have to deep dive. You think I was just sitting around going, I wonder if men think wiping their ass is gay. No.
You be going on different sides of the internet and the what's that? Because you be up all times of the hours. So you just you found out people out there ain't wiping their ass because they said they it's gay. It's
gay. Really? I've seen it on threads. On Facebook. Yes.
Steven.
Yeah.
Steven, is that the reason that some
wiping made me gay?
Is that what did it?
Sometimes.
No, really. You was wiping and you got the long fingers.
Oops. There it is. No, really. There's a subsection. There's a subset of men who have decided that some things are gay.
Now I have.
I'm looking at different articles on this, and one says clean anus equals gayness.
Yeah, you thought I was making that up. You Googled it, and there it is.
I just wanted to know. I mean,
clean anus make you gayness.
Clean anus equals gayness. That's stupid.
Okay, I was blown away
when I first started reading it. I'm like, this just has to be a joke. But they kept doubling down on it. Like, that's gay.
Yeah, I mean, and then apparently it's a whole discussion on Reddit.
Women writing in and said, my husband refuses to wipe his behind and I'm going to divorce him. I'm like, how long did it take for you to figure this out?
Yeah.
How did it come up in conversation?
I bet you.
Excuse me. He has to wash his underwear. Or, you know.
I bet you they was white. Excuse me, Steve.
You don't have to expose yourself for that one. That sounds like a very white problem, doesn't it?
I can't imagine anybody of any color.
I know you've seen. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, let me ask a sub question to you brought it up. About white people. And by the way, I don't disagree with you. It probably is. But I find that Black people are a lot more accepting of gay people than white people. It's just kind of a fact. And also to go with that, I also find that Jewish people are a lot better about gay people than Gentile people. So would you agree with that, that in your experience, Black people have a lot less hang up or would you say they're very conservative culture and they don't?
I believe.
Go ahead.
You're going to go. I was going to say, I believe that it's kind of like in us to, you know what I'm saying, to help the downtrodden and
marginalized.
The marginalized, because we've been so marginalized from the inception. So I believe that, you know, even if we still be like, all right, man, you gay, as long as you didn't try to put your finger in my ass, come on, let's go shoot.
Now,
you know, man, I'll take you a cup. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you can sleep in the bed with me, man. Just stay on that side. God damn it. You know what I'm saying?
Now, I find as a gay woman, as a lesbian, late in life, coming up during the era of really bad homophobia and marginalization, that Black people are very homophobic. And it's wrapped in a Christian blanket. And yeah. So there's the duality that comes with that, that love the sinner, hate the sin kind of thing. But there's still a condemnation. It's like, even in their acceptance, you funny, but you can ride as long as you stay over there kind of thing. And I had, you know, being out of the community per se for as long as I have been, and I mean out of the hood and into the more integrated segments of society. When I went back and started working clubs again, you know, it's cool. I have no problem working in front of Black people. But then there was a subcurrent that was troubling. And I did one show where I sat through the whole show and it was like, oh, I got more and more uncomfortable with the gay jokes, with the put downs, with the whole assumption that, again, I'll put up with you, but there's something wrong with you. You don't fit into this main group.
Right. There's something wrong. I mean,
yes.
So you're the funny part, and being gay is the punchline, because there's something, ultimately, there's something wrong with being gay.
Yes. We love you anyway.
Yeah.
Kind of.
But I find that white people are just the same way. They're just the same way.
Yeah,
especially white Christian people. Which is why I say Jewish people seem to be really cool and fine. They don't really care. But there are conservative Jewish people as well.
Well, we have gay. The funny thing is, we have gays in every segment of society, in past, present, future, whatever. There's always been gay people. They're always going to be. And what I don't understand, and what I can't get a straight answer to, is, what's it to you? What's it to you if a trans kid or a trans person transitioned? What's it to you? I don't understand the whole angst and whatever that people seem to get so worked up about. It has nothing to do with you.
Well, as someone who was brought up in a particular church that is now split, you know, I was brought up United Methodist, and just recently the United Methodist Church split into two parts: United Methodist that accepts gay people and will marry gay people, and now a new Methodist church called the Global Methodist Church that rejects gay marriage and gay ministers. I have to tell you, it is fear. It is fear, fear, fear.
Fear, I mean, of what?
Well, fear of accepting something that you're going to go to hell for.
What, gay rubs off?
No, is that if you accept gay people, then you're going to hell. And that's not right. And if you were supporting it, then you're just as bad as they are.
What kind of God condemns his own
God?
creation? He could, this, you will grant that God created these people like me, and now not only does he condemn us, he wants you to fix me. What the fuck kind of religion is that? It makes no sense.
It's a global Methodist religion is what it is.
It's all of them, you know, at the source, it's all of them. All of the ones that I've run across, they have that same underlying whatever. Nobody wants to sleep with you just because they're gay.
It'd be a church full of dirty anuses.
I ain't going white. That's gay.
Anyway, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? He wouldn't wipe.
No, he'd submerge everybody in the river. That's pretty much what he did.
I'll have a drink to that.
What are you drinking? Looks like you're drinking ice cream. What are you drinking?
No, I was just to piggyback off what Mom said at the beginning of the show. We can drink out of what we want to.
Oh, okay. It looked like an ice cream.
Well, you were drinking.
It is ice cream. It is ice cream, but I got a little something.
What was in the jug that you was drinking?
Oh, that was juice. But this is liquor.
Oh, okay.
That's juice. This is liquor.
I hardly know. Juice, anyway, before we get out of here, I want to take some time to be a little more serious. We are the most serious comedy show ever, but that's life. Anyway,
we've been on here 3 hours.
Anyway, this week, well, in the past couple of weeks, we have lost two very important people to our community, Malcolm Jamal Warner and Jewel Thias Williams. They both, in different circumstances, got their wings, so to speak. And Jewel had a celebration of life. A couple of celebration of life events that were well represented and gave the community an opportunity to say thank you to a woman who gave so much to that community. And I'm going to play a little video of her and some shots of her home going right now.
My dad would still ask me, you know, when you gonna get married, Jewel? You know, because he loved me so much. My family, when they found out that I was gay, they kind of ignored it or act like it wasn't happening. So when Rue and I were gonna have our commitment ceremony, I went to them, to my parents then, and I said, I know you have to know, but I need to tell you because I need to speak this out loud to take the power out of the stigma of my being who I am. And Rue and I are going to get married and I would like for you both to come. So my dad spoke his word and said his religion wouldn't allow him to come. So my mom, being who she is, a day or two before the ceremony, she calls and said that she's not going to attend. She didn't want to be bothered with that junk. I said, okay, I'm sorry you feel that way. Bless you, anybody. The day of the wedding, one of my sisters and her arrived from San Diego. My sister just couldn't stand not knowing. So she drove, she and my mom drove up from San Diego. And my mom had the best old time at the reception and meeting people and seeing, because it was big and it was glamorous. It was flawless, okay. I guess she had wanted that for her other daughters too, but she didn't get it. But she was cool.
May she rest in peace. And thank you for so much, Jewel. When I was on Night Court and didn't know whether to shit or go blind, tell you the truth about being gay. And being gay was something I couldn't even really admit to myself, even though I was living it in my personal life. And not being able to socialize or to be out, I would go to the Catch One during the day and try not to be famous and just sit at the bar and have a drink. And Jewel would talk to me. She could see who I was. I'm sure she's seen that picture in different masks millions of times. And she talked to me and let me know it was okay, that it was okay. She saw me and gave me comfort. And I thank her for that and for all of the people that she served during the AIDS crisis. She stepped up when nobody else would and took in and treated people in her clinic. She's just lived an amazing life, and we hope she rests in peace. And Malcolm Jamal Warner, while Jewel lived a long life, Malcolm's was cut short and touched. His life and his passing has touched so many people who felt they had lost a family member. He was not only introduced to us as America's brother, but even as he went on with his career and his activism and his family life, he was a dedicated father and husband. He was a musician. He was a poet. He was just a good man. And I have met him, but he was at the show where the show Robert Townsend did and Eddie Murphy produced at the, I can't think of the name of the theater, too emotional, but we'll show it a little later on. But he was there the night I was saying I would wanted to climb Magic Johnson. He always brought that joke up. But I know his mother, and I cannot imagine what she's going through, what we all feel. And knowing Pamela Warner and knowing what mothering is, how she gave Noel her son, and he served us all well. My heart goes out to her, and I hope more than anything that she knows that she has friends. And so to take us out of here, we're going to turn it over to our friend Brad, the old man on the porch, who's going to take a moment to give us a moment to say goodbye. And then we're going to show you a little snippet of a video that'll give us all a reason to live. Thank you, Leanne Lord. Thank you.
Hello.
My son.
Thank you, Mom. How are you?
And may those you love hold them a little closer. Good night.
We lost Malcolm Jamal Warner last week, and while we want to comfort the family and show our loves, to be honest with you, I just don't know what to say to a family in a time like this. But I do know that it's very important that we just be with them. So I'm just going to sit here for a few seconds and be with the family and pray that their grief and sorrow will morph in its own time past grief and into fond memories. So God bless you. And Malcolm Jamal Warner, rest in the power of God's love. Amen. Amen.
You got it. No one can tell a joke.